In the spring of last year, Christian McEwen interviewed the poet Marianne Baruch when she came to Smith for its poetry reading series. Marianne Baruch is the author of 7 volumes of poetry as well as 2 volumes of prose. She was born in Chicago, grew up in a Polish Catholic family, and was already writing poems by the time she was in high school. Her work is strongly influenced by her Catholic childhood, as well as by her love of nature and her interest in dreams. "I think we get into a dream state when we're writing," she says. "We drop down under the surface and connect with that other realm." Baruch currently teaches in Purdue University's MFA program and through the non-residential program for writers at Warren Wilson College. Her most recent book is Grace Fallen From. Christian McEwen's project interviewing poets who come to read at Smith College is called Sparks from the Anvil.
So let's just start in the beginning with if you would talk a little bit about your growing up. I'm right in thinking that that was in Chicago?
Right. I was born in Chicago quite a long time ago, in the middle of the last century. And, I grew up in the city, but my mother was from a small town in Illinois, so I would spend a lot of my summers down there with my very old grandparents, my grandfather born in about 1875 and my grandmother born in 1883. So that was a wonderful sort of balance on my childhood. I loved going down there where there was no TV and they ate their big meal at noon and, you know, we just sort of sat on the porch and hung out and read books and walked downtown and walked back.
So you had that every summer?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. It was a great old house, you know. It was the perfect grandmother house. And they were really kind of wonderful people, you know, to sort of just be with. And so my brother and I still, one of our favorite things to do is to just sit and go from room to room and discuss all the little things in the rooms.
So you both have
just
very clear
revisit.
Memory.
Remember that little incense burner, the three monkeys, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, and, just little things like that we just treasure. So, yeah, I mean, so I feel like I had the best of both worlds in a certain way. And, my parents, my father, it's the Baruch side. He was the son of immigrants from Poland coming over about 1912 and peasants. So he had a pretty hardscrabble life. And my mother was from this small town, sort of small town gentry. So it was, she was a WASP and she had to convert to Catholicism to marry my father. And my grandmother, my Polish grandmother, was furious because she wasn't Catholic and she wasn't Polish. And she locked herself in a closet for 3 days at the news. But she gradually was won over, and I think my mother became the favorite daughter-in-law finally. So it was odd, my grandparents, my Polish grandparents, didn't really know English very well. So there was that whole thing of a foreign language floating around that we couldn't penetrate really, and seemed so other, although this was our family.
So you didn't yourself speak Polish?
No. My father, that generation, they just wanted to be Americans and shed all that. And I remember overhearing my father once, and he would speak Polish to his parents, but I remember my father once standing in a doorway with my grandmother, my Busha, saying, "Ma, these are American children."
Wow.
So I think it was probably, I remember phrases in Polish, but my real, and as a result, I was really a lot closer to my maternal grandparents. Because I could talk to them, and we would read Winnie the Pooh to each other over and over and over again. So we had that bond about reading and everything else. And yeah, so I feel lucky in that sense that I had both this kind of the city mouse and the country mouse thing going on.
Very nice, actually, to have both those things.
Yeah.
What other books do you remember from your childhood, and when do you think poetry floated into your consciousness?
I don't know, because I remember, grade school, really liking, I have a poem about this called The Poems, To All the Poets One Reads in Childhood. Edna St. Vincent Millay and Sarah Teasdale, all those people that filled our books. John Maysfield. I must go down to the sea again, to all that. And I just love the ringing sounds of those things. The first poet I think really influenced me was Carl Sandburg, because it was the landscape that I knew. It was, you know, cornfields and soybean fields and all that. And that was sort of thrilling to see that you didn't have to be an English poet to write poems, that you could, you know, use what you saw. And so that was a great moment of permission, I think. And so, and I still think his first book, Chicago Poems, is a very strong book. And, you know, he got sort of sentimental and everything. And, you know, and I always think about Frost and Sandburg in the same breath in a certain way, probably because they both had wonderful hair way into their dotage. But Frost, of course, was, you know, just the world's better poet, I think. But there was a kind of expanse in Sandburg, you know, that he was very romantic, really. And so that appealed to me as a young person. But really it was the imagery that was my imagery. But I read everything. I was one of those kids that would read madly, you know, dumb books, good books, didn't matter. And, you know, there was an old Andrew Carnegie Library in Tuscola. That's the town of my grandparents where my mother was raised. And so, you know, I loved that library. I would go there. And when I was a really small child, a distant cousin of my grandfather's was the librarian. Her name was Gladys. And I remember slowly growing tall enough to see her behind the desk, the tall desk in the library. And anyway, so that was, I feel really happy that that was my childhood. And of course, I went to Catholic schools, which wasn't, you know, unusual. And I think about, in those days, about a third of the children in Chicago went to Catholic schools. You know, it was really a Catholic city with all the immigration and the Irish and the Eastern Europeans and the Southern Europeans. And so we moved around quite a bit because my father was a realtor, and he would always see a good deal on a new house. And we'd always move in the dead of winter because that's when houses look the worst, and so they're cheaper. Just a little tip there. But that meant we got pulled out of school, and eventually we ended up in the very edge of Chicago. But I went on to Catholic school. I went to an all-girl Catholic high school, and which was wonderful, actually, and totally surreal. And, you know, we loved defacing our uniforms and pulling various stunts like painting the toes of the statues, the toenails red, and putting, you know, those big statues of Christ with holding his hands out. I got caught. I was up on a chair putting yarn on his hands, you know, so he'd be holding. And my friend Deborah Durkin, who was a comic genius, was holding the yarn, and as I was doing it, I was talking to her, and so I looked down, and there was Sister Sulpice going, a little crook finger, come with me, and my friend was nowhere to be seen, and I don't already in the hoosegal, so, but it was really, I think, great fun. I mean, you know, Catholic schooling in those days, of course, that was pre-Vatican II, so it was really the old school, I guess. I was right in the middle of the baby boom, so we had huge numbers in our classrooms of 50 kids in a classroom with one teacher. But in spite of that, I mean, we all learned to read, and, you know, math and science, a little questionable, but, you know, the other things, I think it was a very good education.
When did you start reading Sandburg, and when did you start writing yourself?
Oh, well, I would walk home from school and, you know, and I would sort of invent poems in my head. I think I started writing them down maybe in seventh, eighth grade. And then in high school, I was pretty serious writing my poems. And, yeah, I mean, it was always part of my life. I think that I would copy things out by hand. I would copy stories. I copied the entire, you know, The Old Man and the Sea. I think actually that's a great exercise. I've known people that do that, that retype things because they feel like, you know, of established writers to learn from them. They feel like then they run it through their body word by word, and they can really get a sense of the syntactical structure and just the emotive build and so on, and that they feel it physically. And of course, that's what memorizing poems does. I make my students do, even my graduate students. And I think that's a wonderful way actually to sort of understand a poem because, you know, you keep running it through your body over and over again over years. You just see more and more things about it. It's kind of a great thing.
Did the nuns make you do that at school?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, certainly in grade school, we had to memorize all sorts of catechism stuff, you know, all the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit and all these sort of now quite surreal things. I mean, I'm a lapsed Catholic, but I think that that education was useful for a poet. I mean, or anyone who's thinking in sort of a figurative way, I think, because it's so bizarre, for one thing. And those stories are so great. You know, the lives of the saints. Even now, you know, I've in this new manuscript I finished recently, I sort of used some things from the lives of the saints, and those stories are just completely bizarre. Some saint who was the offspring of a prostitute in an inn, and whose father was a wandering, I love this, a wandering camel acrobat in a circus in Asia Minor somewhere, you know? I'm thinking, suddenly, this whole era opens up, and you just see this wild stuff going on. And, of course, we had jokes about that in high school. Once I got to high school, we were all pretty cynical, and this whole sort of black humor thing we shared, and nobody had any dates or anything, but, of course, the nuns thought we were madly having them. And so they were full of all sorts of dating tips for us, which we just struggled to keep from laughing when they were told to us, and we just loved them, you know, until we could escape to the bathroom and the laboratory and just laugh ourselves sick over it.
Can you remember any of those dates?
Oh,
tips?
Yeah. Like, actually, I've written about this because I just finished a memoir where I sort of touch on some of this stuff. But, yeah, the dating tips from Sister Sulpice might... Well, there's the standard ones, like don't wear pearls as if we would in those days. They reflect down. Don't eat if you go out with a boy, don't go to a place with white tablecloths because it reminds them of
sheets,
bed sheets. And don't, if you go to an Italian restaurant, never, never, never order ravioli because it reminds them of,
I don't know,
little pillows.
Oh, no.
And you know where that, but our favorite, our absolute favorite was, if it's been raining, now, of course, you're wearing a skirt on a date. That just goes without saying, okay? If it's been raining, carry a little bag of stones with you. Because when you're walking along and you're going to cross over a puddle, you whip out the stones and you drop them in and you break the reflection. And so we would just, that was our favorite. We just went insane, you know, hearing this. And the other thing was that, like, of course, this is before seatbelts or anything like that, so we were cautioned, you know, if you're going to a place and there's a lot of people in the car and you have to sit on a boy's lap. I'm surprised they even said you could sit on a boy's lap, but now, when I think about that, but if that's going to happen, you must take with you the Chicago phone book. Now, the Chicago phone book was about 4 inches
yes.
thick, right?
That's so, a conversation stopper.
And you put the phone book down on the lap, and then you sit on the lap. And so we had this whole scenario that we love to think about. Like, okay, so you're on the date, it's raining, and you take a little bag of stones and the Chicago phone book, and you show up with that. And so I'm thinking of this poor woman just dreaming this up, you know. Mm. And of course, this is classic high school stuff anywhere, but I think we took such joy in that, probably because it was such a rigid environment. So we had a whole secret life of sort of mocking it, but really liking it at the same time. And, of course, all that religious imagery, everything means something else. We had a teacher who, what was that called? I forget what she called it, but, she called it deep meaning. And this is an English teacher, and she would write these little essays, like, she said, okay, what's the deep meaning of a pencil or, you know, a sheet of paper or a pair of socks? And we have to sit there and invent some meaning.
Just teaching you metaphor, essentially.
So we called that DM. So we were always joking, you know, what's the DM of a Kotex? What's the DM of, you know, what's the DM of a jockstrap, you know, or something? So, I mean, but all those things are exercises, I think, to that double level. Mm-hmm. And, of course, any religious tradition is like that, mm-hmm. you know. But that religious tradition is particularly rich, I think, historically that way. Mm-hmm. And all these unseen things, right? And And that's that idea of the examination of conscience, right, where you sort of watch yourself in a certain way. So this is sort of, which can be very overwhelming and kind of annoying, but it is a kind of sense of a meditative sense right away. And, you know, you're doing that when you're 7 years old, right, mm-hmm. before you're the whole confession thing and stuff. So mm-hmm. although my belief is gone, I'm sure all those things have influenced me a lot.
Was losing your belief complicated and painful, or is it something that just fell away as you reached adolescence? And
I think poetry, my brother accuses me of this, although he's a lapsed Catholic too, probably worse than I am, but I think that that my love of poetry kind of replaced it, and that poetry was a kind of way to touch the other realm, right? To cross over, mm-hmm. to feel that double life, to go into the self and watch that self in a way disappear mm-hmm. and connect to larger things. I think that's what happened. It was a transfer of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Were there any teachers who were genuinely inspiring and who understood you as a young poet and were in some ways trying to encourage you?
I did have a high school, our freshman, we had a lay teacher, you know. Her name was Rita Hohmeyer, and she was really scary to us. And I remember a girl got up and read a piece that she'd written about a talking raincoat, and it was very maudlin and stuff. Of course, we loved it. We thought it was so great. And there was this pause, and then Rita Hohmeyer said, "That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard in my life." And everyone was like, "Oh, oh no," you know. And, you know, a little part of me, I was the same way, but a little part of me was thinking, she's right. That was really maudlin, you know? And it was. And that was my first touch, a sense of a rather austere intelligence. She was very smart, and we all knew that, and she was really scary to us. But, you know, she took no prisoners. But that was a sensibility that I never had seen before. Mm. And that was really interesting to me, mm. you know? And like we read The Stranger, I remember being shocked. My mother died yesterday, or was it today, or whatever, however that opens, the sort of indifference. That's another sensibility, mm-hmm. right? So in a way, and that's what was so great about Winnie the Pooh, right, when I was a kid, was that A.A. Milne, all those different sensibilities, adult sensibilities, are sort of reflected in, you know, the officious rabbit and the, you know, the sort of know-it-all owl who really doesn't know things and is always covering up and, you know.
The self-pitying Eeyore.
He was, of course, our favorite, right? Because he was the sweet cynic. And that was a great modeling for choices or, you know, sensibilities that, of course, you go through all those in your life in one person, right? There's no self, really, in that sense. Mm. You know.
So when did you come across teachers who really did inspire and help you? Was that at college level or among your own friends as a graduate?
Well, I mean, I was really a solitary reader. I mean, I don't think in college, I mean, I went to the University of Illinois, Champaign, big school. You know, I was, again, the baby boom, so there were just zillions of us. And the best teachers I had actually were in history, or for a long time I wanted to be an archaeologist or an historian then. So, I mean, I loved all that. My English teachers, I remember, that was really, I mean, I did end up majoring in English, and, well, English and history both. So, and I also got a teaching certification for high school and stuff. So, because I'm the generation where my mother said, well, you can go to college, you know, because you should have a career in case your husband dies, and you can fall back on that. An important book to me, though, was an anthology that came out in 1968. I was 18, and I bought it with my last $3, a very dramatic gesture in the bookstore. It was called The Young American Poets, edited by Paul Carroll. It's a big, thick, red book. Sometimes I find them at garage sales. I always buy them. And that was wonderful. I mean, I was introduced to Simic, to James Tate, who I later studied with at UMass, to, you know, Merwin was in there. You know, there were just lots and lots of people. Ron Padgett, the whole New York School, and lots of people have disappeared, right? And later when I graduated from college and I worked for 4 years in Chicago, I just had these crummy jobs and then I was substitute teaching and so on. I sat in on Paul Carroll's workshop at the University of Illinois at Circle Campus, we called it then, just south of the Loop there. And he let me just be in the class and pay no money. And he was very encouraging to people, you know. I always thought he should be more critical, but I see now that he was just really welcoming and encouraged people that way. I also sat in on Bill Knott's workshop at Columbia College. Then Columbia was just basically one tiny building on the north side, kind of a wreck. It was just sort of a shoestring operation. And he taught part-time, and he was quite fierce. And so it was interesting to have those two men coming from different, very different sides. And so they're really the first two who looked at my work and responded to it.
And were you already doing what you described last night as trying to mess it up? You know, I loved what you said about looking at the flowers and trying not to come at them with the usual predictable romantic attitude, but instead trying to make something of your own.
Yeah.
So had you already begun that way of working?
Well, I don't know. I hope so. I mean, it was a big deal for me to actually show my work in that kind of setting, given my history of dropping out of it and finding it so embarrassing. But I just love certain poets who were writing in that sort of wise guy, kind of smart-ass way, and I like that a lot. But I also, you know, I always when I teach, you know, I ask, say, my graduate students in particular, like, what's their range? You know, what's in terms of, I think that we do something and then we long to do the opposite, right? And that's just the human condition. And so I always ask what their range is. What's the farthest reach they've gone in either direction, opposite directions?
Great question.
You know, because I just want to know where they see their borders or whatever, their imaginative borders or tonal borders or whatever. So, and I think in my case, I mean, I love that kind of smart-ass, playful thing. But after a while, that gets, it seems too, you get sick of it. You know, you think this is just, you know, kind of silly and self-indulgent in a certain way. And then I also love the quite serious poems, and so I love that side. So how to reconcile those things? I mean, that's been the struggle of my whole writing life, I think. And so I hope eventually for a poem that'll have both those things. And a lot of people do that. I mean, thinking about Charles Simic, who, you know, has great darkness and yet great playfulness at the same time. But, of course, as soon as I say that, I can think of, you know, very earnest poets like Louise Glick, who, or Ellen Voigt, or who, you know, are earnest straight through. I mean, there's not that playfulness.
Are they a couple to whom you return? I mean, if you had
absolutely.
Up with a short list of contemporary poets whom you admire or respect or return.
Yeah,
to.
I would include them, and Bridget Kelly. I would include Lucia Perillo. I would, and Tony Hoagland. Tony Coleman wore that smart-ass crowd with Mark Holliday, maybe Dean Young, some of it. I like early Dean Young a lot. The stuff that he's turned his back on. there's so many people writing wonderful things. Laura Jensen, who doesn't write much anymore, but I love her first three books, her only books, really. You know, she's the more earnest, but she's very... I mean, some poems, I think, some poets in general, but some poems in particular have in them the source of poetry. You know, I feel that way about certain pieces of, say, Milosz or Zagajewski even, and you can feel that in all kinds of work. I mean, even Paul Carroll, who is not, you know, was really known for, you know, he edited that anthology, he tried to edit a Midwest version of the Yale Younger Poets, the Big Table series, and Bill Knott, his first book was in that series, and another poet named Dennis Schmitz, who wrote a book called We Weep for Our Strangeness that was important to me in my 20s. And, you know, even Paul Carroll, who was himself a poet, but there's like, I was just thinking about him, and there's one poem that I really loved, you know, in my 20s, where he's talking about his father, I forget the name of it, Ode to My... his book of odes. It's set in, he's walking under an underpass from the beach, from the lake, you know, on the lake shore of Lake Michigan. And he's walking under this underpass that crosses under Lakeshore Drive into the city. And he's thinking all these thoughts, all these things he's wheeling about his father who's gone. And he's thinking about all these things, you know, both good and bad about him and kind of wrying, kind of attacking and kind of loving at the same time and so on. And the final, there's something really wonderful that happens at the end of the poem. All this kind of minutia is building up, building up, building up. And then there's at the very end, suddenly he says, this underpass is endless. And suddenly we return to the moment of the actual physical situation. He's under there. And then, of course, you know, the weight of all those things are pressing on that closing line. And so you have real, that's wonderful closure, it seems to me, because it returns, it turns, it picks up the weight of everything before it. And yet it's absolutely real. It's physical. It's not. And so, you know, an ending like that, I mean, I find that very moving. That poem to me has the source of poetry in it, which is to open up, right? And to go deeper and to somehow address things in one swoop at many levels, right? Which is really kind of thrilling and inspiring. And suddenly you look up from such a poem and, you know, everything's in that underpass. Everything is endless, right? So, I mean, a good poem, I think, works that way. So, yeah, it's just such a great mysterious form, the poem.
I love how you describe that. Thank you. I like that idea of everything being in one poem. Compact, you know, compacted there.
Yeah, and when just following that movement of mind is so neat. You know, you're watching it reinvent itself.
Well, that was something I was thinking about in reading your Grace book was the movement of mind and when you knew a poem was finished, because you are in so many places going on your nerve in terms of the way the poem is shaped. You're inventing the shape as you write.
Oh, yeah, I try not to have an agenda, really.
So
I've always resisted traditional form for that reason, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a little, I begin, you know, I'm finally maturing in the sense I see that its resources are quite rich, but, you know, for years I just dismissed it as putting your poem in an ice cube tray or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to say that I'm of the begging bowl theory of poetry. You put out your begging bowl and stuff drops in and then you work with that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I really don't want to know where it's going. I want to just follow one line, triggers the next line, triggers the next line, because that's the great adventure of it. If you have it all worked out, you're just recovering it. You're not finding it. You're not letting it kind of come to you. It's in its own little creature life, you know.
Mm.
And, of course, revision is a great thing. You get, you know, a draft, and then you start tinkering and finding out what you really, where it really wants to go, and it kind of tells you. It's like children tell you how to raise them, you know. I remember a nurse told us that when our son was born. Oh, he'll just tell you what to do. He'll just tell you how to raise them. Mm. And that's true. She was absolutely right. Mm.
It takes a certain courage and a sense of your own sensibility, a confidence in your own originality, I think, to make poems in that way. Not everybody.
You think?
Well, I think not everybody is able to.
I think it's giving up all that. I mean, I think of it as giving up, like, you know, because you're trying to drop the will. You're trying to drop your little plan for it, you know, and letting it sort of just come about. I mean, that's my experience of it.
Mm. Listening.
I don't think it's, yeah, I don't really, I'm not sure it's confidence. It's more like being a receiver,
okay.
And being a certain way more passive.
Mm. But that connects to the other thing that occurred to me as I was reading the Grace book was the number of poems that had to do with dreams. And I wanted to ask you about your relationship with dream, because it seems so rich and to have infused so many of your poems.
I am fascinated with the notion that, you know, we spend about a third of our life sleeping and nobody really knows what happens. Where are we when we sleep? I mean, people look dead. But the whole thing about dream, I don't really remember my dreams too much, but I think we do get into a kind of dream state when we're writing, you know, that we sort of go like, we drop down under the surface and we're trying to connect with that other realm somehow, even though every poem demands lots of hard image, lots of furniture to keep, you know, to keep it visible, I guess you might say. That's really important to me, to have that accessibility. But at the same time, it's something's pulling it down, you know, into a kind of unconscious regions. And that's another great thing about poems, that it does it's sort of between worlds, you know. And so I guess dream comes in, I guess, a lot in that book.
So if dream is one source, Catholicism is one source, I saw nature as being another enormous source for you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, well, yeah, the flower poems. Mm-hmm. But, well, this last collection, the one I just finished, the one unpublished, but pieces are, you know, they're coming out in various journals, or have come out. My little hair shirts, I call them, the little quatrains. But there's several lines of thought and image that go through that manuscript, that collection. But a lot of it was all written in the woods. I'd rather be in the woods than anywhere. And I was at a place called Hall Farm in Vermont, where I did a lot of those little hair shirts, which, and I was just, I'm a birder, and I could hear, you know, the amazing birds would, I could hear them in the morning, and I would walk in the woods there. And so it was a great experience doing those poems because they just kept coming so fast and furious, you know. And part of my, it was the same impulse as with the flowers. I wanted to take the natural world and treat it in some odd way. I mean, really, the woods is just full of sex and violence, let's face it. I mean, it's not pretty in the normal way. There's so much ruthlessness that goes on. And we're so privy to so little of it, really. And we can coat it over, you know, with its beauty and so on. But I wanted to get beyond that, to its strangeness in that. And so those exercises, those pieces really, I hope, tap that. There's just many deal with the natural world. And then later I was artist in residence at a national park, which in this country is kind of great. The national parks have artist in residence programs, and sometimes they even tolerate writers. Mostly they want painters and things, but there are some that you can apply as a writer. And I applied to this place, the most isolated national park in the country, which it's called Isle Royal. It's in the middle of Lake Superior. And it's a six-hour ferry ride from the top of Michigan, Houghton, Michigan, to get to it. And the whole island is a national park. And so and there are no roads, there are no stores, there's no towns. It's just this little harbor and the visitor center. It's a hotel there, and it's basically for backpackers. The hotel is quite expensive, so it's for rich hotel goers and backpackers, basically. But it's an amazing island, and it has the longest predator-prey study in the world, wolf and moose, been going on since like the 40s. And anyway, we were given a cabin there. I could bring my family. They gave us a canoe. And we were there for, you know, like almost 3 weeks.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
And that was amazing because I would write all morning and then we'd go out and adventure. So that place fed the work too. I mean, I wrote a lot of the little hair shirts there. So the natural world does enter in a lot on those poems. And, you know, I wanted to be scared. I wanted to be an underling in that landscape in a way, right? Because it is very mysterious, that land. I mean, we have, you know, what is it like to be non-human? What is that world like? There's no way we can imagine that, really. I wanted that otherness in there. I guess I wanted to make the strange stranger instead of making the strange familiar, which, of course, is what you're supposed to do in art, or do the reverse, right? Make the familiar strange. But, so, yeah, I mean, that's important to me. And you're a nature writer, right? So
Well, one of the things, yeah. But it interests me that what you said last night about the God poems, where you said they were scary to write and the scariness was itself a reason to persist with them. And
yeah.
Now again, you're saying, you know, in a sense, go in the direction of your fear and translate it into something.
Well, your fear and your wonder,
yeah.
Right, which are sometimes linked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, nature is very important to me. I mean, the natural detail, I guess I would say. The nice thing about Isle Royal is that the Dassler family cabin, which these were all cabins, you know, mm-hmm. bought by the park, began in the 30s, and so they went in there and bought all these family. People had their family cabins, right? And they would sell them to the park or have a life lease on them. They'd put their 2-year-old baby on the lease, and so those 2-year-old babies are now, you know, dying off. So then the park moves in and takes the cabins. The artist in residence cabin is the Dassler family cabin. Last Dassler, I guess, died in 1993, And it's a wonderful place. And it has a little sort of secondary cabin, like a guest cabin, a few steps down the trail. And so I would go and work there all morning with my pot of tea and everything. But I do keep an image journal, a little notebook where I write down things I see and think about. But it was fairly, I mean, as I say, this was sort of an amazing experience for me to do this manuscript, because things just kept coming and coming and coming. It's just like I'd sit down and they were just all gifts, you know. I mean, it was kind of amazing. I don't know exactly what happened there.
So, your receptivity and the magic of the place and the timing.
Well, that
was just all
and,
right.
Yeah, and I think the fact that they're all 16 lines. I mean, I never had any kind of. I mean, as you were saying before, I usually let things take their shape, and whatever that is, it is. But in this case, I really kept it to these 16 lines, and so, which was a certain way freeing, because I get to the end, okay, next, next one. And when I came home and I was reading them to my husband, I said, okay, I'm not even going to pause between these. I'm just going to, because they just seem like one, boom, next, next, next. And they were just, and then when I read Dickinson again, it just seemed like, that's the way those came. I mean, I felt like there was a certain, not that I'm Dickinson, but not by a long shot, but what I'm saying is there was a certain new sense of that process. It seemed I began to understand Dickinson in a new way and how those must have come fast and furious, or even, you know, some of those poems, when we talk about Plath's poems and Ariel, she was writing, what, 3 or 4 a day in that last year, just madly coming out. And so I felt like I was in the same kind of space in a certain way. Again, not that I'm comparing myself to these two giants. I'm just saying that my experience with that helped me understand what they were doing and how incredible what they were doing, that was. Mm. And just how exciting that was. And I almost felt like I wasn't even doing them. It was like, you know. And, of course, that's what happens when you write a poem. You think, who wrote this, right?
Yeah.
If you think it works, you think, who wrote this?
Yeah.
Right? It's like the spirit life takes over or something. Mm. And that I feel really grateful for that experience. And then I kept working on those poems, and I would write some more too. And I mean, there's lines, you know, about the woods, about natural detail, the natural world that runs through those. There's a whole series of God poems. There's a whole series in there of that are kind of like vaudeville. I have a speaker who's an old poet who's trying to advise two younger poets. And he's really a pain in the ass, you know, to them. And so that back and forth, call and response kind of thing is running through it. And I got to be sort of really smart ass in those pieces and use language I usually don't use. And that was really great fun. I could also comment on poetry in those. So that runs through it. And there's stuff about my mother's death that runs through it. Mm-hmm. And there's other sort of odds and ends about just, you know, domestic life or whatever that run through it too. So there's some political ones about the war in Iraq and so on. So that it's sort of a mishmash, but it is. I felt like they're almost like secular prayers, because I would get up and I would do one. And so I see them also that in a kind of Book of Hours kind of way. And so there's all sorts of things on that sequence, and they really are kind of a sequence. Mm-hmm. And and I was also guided by, you know, thinking of them as prayers, but by the various hours of prayer, you know, lauds and all that. So they move in that way, too. So there's lots of things that organize them, finally.
It's wonderful when you find a form that's so capacious that really you can pack into it whatever you need to be thinking about.
Well, it makes you brave.
Yeah.
It makes you think, what the hell? You know, just keep going with this, right? But the containment, I think, was also a kind of the fact that, you know, they were in their little hair shirts in the quatrains, I think made me feel, it was a kind of solace. You know, poems are built of tension, repose and, you know, and action and, you know, darkness and light and all that kind of thing. I mean, there's something that needs to ground it and something that needs to have it just take flight. And so those things are always at war. And that's what the tension is. And that's why it's such a cool form. Mm-hmm. But to do that in a small space takes certain amount of, I don't know what, to keep it going, keep it lively throughout, you know. Mm. Anyway, it was great fun. I just really and really interesting to me and kind of scary. So all those things. But it is nice. When you feel like things are working or that you're involved in something that is way larger than your little tiny life, it's thrilling, really.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as I say, it just helped me read people like the urgency in those poems, like in Plath's later work, or certainly Dickinson writing her little notes everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, two questions. That was wonderful what you were just saying about Dickinson and the shape, the helpfulness of a particular form. One thing I was wondering about was how your relationship to poetry differs from your relationship to prose, because you've also written several prose books.
Well, not several. I have two books of essays on poetry, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the essay is actually closer to poetry than, say, fiction is to poetry. I think, you know, they're both meditative forms. They both kind of exist outside time. Normal sense of time, you know, you get up, you have your tea, you put your, you know, you go to work, whatever. The normal sense of time, that progression is not required. You can fly around, you can go in and out of things. And so, in that way, they're sort of siblings, and they're easy to pass one to the other. I think, and in both, the way I do an essay anyway, I mean, I could never do that kind of thing where, you know, you have your thesis, and then you, like, have your 3 points, so you support it, and then you have your conclusion, you know. I never could, ever. You know, I was a total disappointment to my teachers in this. I never could do that. I was the kind of student who would write the essay and then write the outline afterwards, you know. So my essays kind of move around. They kind of grow organically, I guess. And I never know, again, it's like poems. I never know where they're going to go. I do research them, though, and I try to deal with poetic issues, not in literary ways, really, although I have a lot of close reading in those essays, but because I think that's important to do. But I try to, like, find something outside of poetry to sort of as a lens, you know, aviation or, you know, music or painting or, you know, there's all different ways I've done this. Thomas Edison and his discoveries of various things, or I try to be as sort of wide-ranging as I can, and that helps me see certain issues about poetry. But they're very hard for me to write, and people tell me, oh, I don't believe that, because they seem like, you know, you're just sort of throwing them off. It's like I struggle so with them, you know, will I live to the end of this paragraph, you know, and then when I get to the end, I'm always surprised. I think, oh my God, I just wrote the end. But I think I want the essays to show a movement of minds, like someone thinking about something, not someone coming really to some grand conclusion, because I really don't think they do that. Someone just kind of turning over this rock and turning over that rock and seeing stuff underneath and thinking, oh, that's interesting or whatever. And hopefully it kind of moves towards some sort of larger thing. I hope they do, but I don't presume that they do. I don't dare claim that, I think. But, you know, I just want to show a mind, you know, concerned with these questions. It's like in math, you know, where they say, show your work. Don't just give the answer. I mean, I want to show the work. And I guess I want to do that in poems too, but it's less willed, you know, certainly. I mean, there I'm just grateful for one line after another, and I just watch that unfold, and I want to cross over to another realm. That's all I know. But of course, you do research on things. You have all these things you want to get in, this cool thing and that cool thing. And I have a friend who accuses me, Susan Neville is a wonderful writer, and she writes fiction and essays, and she said, oh, you know, you just have these great anecdotes, and you just want to, like, write around the anecdotes the stuff about poetry. And I'm thinking, that's kind of true, really. But what the hell, right? Yeah.
So the essays are more of a mental journey, and the poems are more of a intuitive, receptive.
Yeah, but, you know, mode. But I want to have that mode also in the essays. Yeah. And I'm writing the essays really to educate myself, since, you know, I feel like I'm so poorly educated, as we all are, really. There's huge holes in our education. And so I think, you know, in that sense, I want to find out things and, you know, how other writers do things, how they think about things, how that works.
So we're coming to the end, alas. I'm very sad about this, but I wondered if there was anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to say or that was on your mind that's pressing and important.
I just think I feel like I'm very lucky, that's all. I really feel like I'm lucky that I've just to have found poetry, or that it found me, or that it's something I can do. And I don't really think of myself as a poet as such, as I think of someone who writes poems, which I think is sort of a different thing in a certain way. But I've been lucky to have teachers, you know, we didn't even mention UMass, but, you know, my teachers there, James Tate and Joe Langland and Donald Junkins, were, you know, very different from each other and very helpful. And this sort of solitary way, too, that I've been allowed to move toward, trying to figure out what that poem, what a poem is, which I think still gets more and more mysterious to me. I really don't know what it is, but it's really a wonderful form, literary form, the closest we have to silence, really. They're just amazing creatures.
Thank you. That's a great place to end. Thank you very much for this.
And that was Christian McEwen interviewing poet Marianne Baruch. Her project, interviewing poets who read at the Smith College Poetry Series, is Sparks from the Anvil.